So today we've been giving a lot of our attention to body and breath. And I want to speak a little bit more about body and its place in practice. As many of you will know, it's the first foundation of mindfulness, the place where we bring our attention to as a way to arrive, as a way to be more present and to settle into the here and nowness of our experience. Giving our attention to what arises in the body is important because we tend to preference mind over body. We give more value to our cognitive understanding than our sensate experience. And so mindfulness of the body, we could say, is a journey of descent, a journey or rather a way in which we give our attention to the sensations of the body as they arise. We notice the tingling, the numbness, the vibrational qualities, the heat, the coolness. We want to know our experience in the body in this very simple and direct way, just to feel all the sensations as they arise in the here and now. It's important to attend to the body because, although we often struggle with our minds, our bodies also contain much of the suffering that we encounter in life. They reflect all the difficulties we encounter through contraction, through tightness, through tension. And so listening to the body and receiving the experience of the body is important if we are to let go of ways in which we've hardened against ourselves, hardened against the world and against others. Perhaps in a moment of anger or feeling under attack, you've noticed how cold you can become. There can almost be an iciness in the body that isn't really limited to just the body. It gets conveyed in the way we look at people, the way we speak, the way we act. Our eyes can be icily cold or burning with hatred, reflecting a hurt or a fear. They can also reflect the experience of love, of compassion and care. And so our bodies can really be a barometer of everything that is going on for us, everything we think, everything we feel. So part of our journey towards greater freedom is to really receive the experience of the body and not to judge the experience, but to know it more deeply so that it can be released, so that we can soften and melt and relax the contractions and the defensiveness that keep us stuck in pain and suffering. So mindfulness of the body is really foundational in Buddhist practice. And it's not that we first do mindfulness of the body and then we forget about this and move on to deeper teachings. This is always with us. It's foundational in that without really allowing our awareness to land in the immediacy of our experience, in the immediacy of this embodied experience, our minds are likely to remain scattered rather than collected. And so as we progress in our meditation practice, in our exploration of our experience, mindfulness of the body remains a constant throughout everything we do, throughout every moment of our practice, every moment of our day. The Satipatthana Sutta is the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness. And it invites us to establish mindfulness within the body, whether we are sitting, standing, walking or lying down, whether we're moving or being still. And so there's not a moment in which mindfulness of the body is not a helpful practice. not just helpful in terms of feeling less stressed or more present, but actually an indispensable part of the path that leads towards freedom and away from suffering. And in our daily life, to be more aware of what's happening in the body is a really great support for being more present and for suffering less. And so we give our attention to the body because we want to live more wisely in this body. Actions of body, speech and mind can be skillful or unskillful. And without awareness of our embodied experience, we tend to fall into less skillful ways of being, less skillful ways of expressing ourselves and being in the world. And we can talk about body, this four-letter word. It's so short, it's so familiar, we all think we know what it means. But I think it's important to start exploring a little deeper. Very often we speak of my body, of this body, or simply the body. And yet to sink deeper, ever deeper into greater mindfulness of the body, we need to be willing to question our familiar ways of knowing body. So often we rely on familiar conventions, almost an unquestioned assumption that we know what we're talking about. Very often a conceptual way of knowing our body, an image of the body, an idea of the body. This first foundation of mindfulness really invites us to go beyond conceptual ways of knowing, beyond the familiar, beyond the known, and to meet our embodied experience in all its aliveness, in all its discomfort, in all its pleasure, in all its confusion, and in all of its mystery. Words and language are absolutely necessary and useful. We can't live without concepts. But they are only pointers towards something that can be known much more directly, much more immediately. Often words and language actually constrain and limit us. They limit our understanding of what it is to be embodied. Almost as if the moment we name our experience, we're ever so subtly disconnected from it. Our conceptual mind usually seeks to understand the body in a very top-down way, by categorizing and naming our experience, chopping it up, dividing it into different categories. Can we instead allow our experience to lead? Can we allow it to be primary? And let the naming and the knowing be secondary? And so rather than top down, from the brain down into the body, and rather than from the outside in, can we move ever deeper into an inside-out, experience-first way of knowing ourselves? In this way of knowing, concepts may not even arise. It may even be difficult to speak of our experience, and yet we can know it. And if we are to let experience lead, we need to develop trust that our experience gives us exactly what we need. And so rather than organizing and managing our experience, rather than fiddling with it and messing with it, rather than trying to change it and make it more appealing to us, we take a body-first orientation and we allow our experience to be as it is. And so I want to invite you into a brief activity. I invite you to take your left index finger, just hold it up, and bring it to your right shoulder. And slowly just trace a line down your shoulder, down the upper arm, through the crook of your elbow, along the forearm, across the wrist, the back of the hand, and down the right index finger. And then changing over and taking the right index finger and tracing a line back up the left arm. Just feeling your fingertip tracing this line on the body. Feel how your body also contacts your finger. All the way up to your shoulder. And stopping there. Just notice how that is for you. Just letting your finger know body, letting your body know your finger. No need to make a problem out of that experience. In fact, no need to make a problem out of any experience that we have. And yet we do. We compare, we judge. And that's not to say we will always enjoy or appreciate our experience. But the very fact we are aware of it allows a sense of perspective and spaciousness around the experience, however difficult it is, however challenging it might be. And here I'm mostly talking about difficult experiences, but we can equally regard pleasant experiences with greater perspective and spaciousness. Indeed, the Buddha's invitation was to develop dispassion towards all experience, the painful, the pleasant, or the neutral. To not become entranced by our experience simply because we like it or dislike it, but to know it ever more fully, ever more deeply. Our experience often doesn't fall into neat categories. It doesn't have to have an emotional or a psychological language associated with it. It doesn't have to have a spiritual language associated with it. Because it is ever-changing, always arising moment to moment, we need to really be current with our experience. The moment we name it, the moment we categorize it, our experience has already changed. And we're looking back retrospectively at a moment that has already passed. And while we need to trust our experience and let our experience lead, that is not to say that we completely reject any kind of cognitive knowing. Mindfulness includes discriminating awareness. This is absolutely central to the task of immersing our awareness in the body. But rather than analysing what is happening, instead we are receiving, we are allowing, we're sensing, we're knowing, and we're being affected by our experience. And we see all the reactivity that can arise, both towards pleasant experiences and away from the unpleasant. And so in the moments where you are tempted to want to name your experience, I invite you to linger, to spend more time, and to really find the word that resonates with the experience itself. Sometimes the words that come are surprising to us. They may not even make sense in a conventional way, and yet they speak to our experience, because of the resonance between the experience and the naming of it. So can we let our language be an expression of the experience rather than being concerned about how we sound or what our words say about us? If it's a good fit, can we allow that word to come? Sometimes we might feel like cardboard, or smooth like butter, or dense or heavy or lifeless, or young or ancient or dull. We might be bright and alive, vibrant and shining. We might be vibrating within or unable to sense what is really going on for us. from this way of looking, even a nothing is a something. The very simple but very direct message from the Buddha was that he taught one thing and one thing only: suffering and the end of suffering. And so the practices and the teachings that we're engaging with on this retreat are leading in the direction of the liberation of heart and mind. And I'm not going to dwell on what liberation or awakening mean, but maybe it's enough just to hold these words as freedom from suffering. Maybe that's enough right now. And so the path of insight meditation is a coherent body of teachings and practices that progressively unfold our capacity for freedom and ease. Or we might say they progressively enlighten us to the way things are. Ignorance is often cited as the primary cause for suffering, that we do not really understand what leads to suffering and what ends it. And so it's not that we are unintelligent or uneducated, but rather that we have a profound and pervasive misunderstanding about who and what we are that causes us to identify with being a separate individual self. And in identifying with this separate individual thing we call me, we miss a much vaster, a more total, a more absolute, and an all-encompassing understanding about the way things are. So one way of understanding this journey of awakening is as a movement from disconnection to wholeness, as a movement from dissociation to greater embodiment, and as a movement from a separate, isolated sense of self to a more connected, a more expanded and less limited understanding of how this sense of self arises, how our sense of the other arises, and how our perceptions shape the appearance of the world. And this isn't simply a process of replacing one set of beliefs with another, but rather allowing our growing awareness, our understanding and our insights to become more embodied in the way that we live and the way that we practice. And when we speak of the end of suffering, it's not that this body won't have its aches and pains. It's not that we won't grow old and eventually die. The whole cycle of life contains some inevitable suffering that is inescapable for any being whatsoever, however rich, however poor, however fortunate we've been in our life. The kind of suffering we can uproot is often spoken of as a second arrow. Inevitably, we encounter many experiences that we dislike, and so we could perhaps say that the art of living an enlightened life is to move with greater ease and freedom through the inevitable ups and downs of an embodied relational life, not being defined or limited by the passing experiences that arise in this heart and mind. So the second arrow that I spoke of is our reaction. It's our reactivity. It's our response to the original hurt, the original pain, the original discomfort that we feel. And this is both a psychological and an embodied reaction. When we have an unpleasant experience on a psychological level, we object, we criticize, we react. And we often define ourselves by what we don't like or what we don't want. On an embodied level, we tighten, we contract, and we want to move away from the experience. On the other hand, when we have a pleasant experience, our tendency is to move towards it, to try and hold on to it, or to get more of it. And whatever the situation, pleasant or unpleasant, our thoughts tend to proliferate. We search for reasons why, explanations, we complain, we criticize, we strategize about how to get more of what we want. This is the second arrow. These largely unconscious reactions to our experience add a layer of suffering that can be alleviated. Mindfulness practices help us cultivate the space between the recognition of an experience that we want to move towards or away from, and our conditioned responses. And when there is more space, there is more possibility of choosing a wise response. One that is informed by a deeper understanding rather than by our reactivity. And it's not that we won't experience reactivity in our lives, but it is possible to hold this more mindfully, more compassionately, as something to be seen and understood. The Buddha recognized that we all have patterns or volitional tendencies, sankharas as they're called in the original teachings. These are our tendencies to react in familiar, well-worn ways. And we take these to be who we are. They are familiar to us. And because they're familiar, we take this to be who and what we are. We wake up and we recognize ourselves each morning. We might even hear ourselves say, oh, I'm a person like this, or I'm a person like that, or I'm not a person like this, or not a person like that. And in doing so, we fix ourselves. We define ourselves by our preferences and by our patterns of reactivity. And then the picture starts to get a little more complex. Because depending on our culture, on our families, on our friends, on our places of work, of our communities, we will have certain ways of being that get validated and preferenced over others. And we may even be praised for being a certain way, for holding certain views. And these can cause us to feel part of something. Most of us tend to get along with those who hold similar ways of being in the world. Gives us a sense of belonging, a sense of safety, and this is really important. This is how communities and families cohere. But all groups are different, all have different norms and different expectations. And I remember in my late teens and my early 20s, I had a friend, and sometimes I would end up staying at a house for tea. A family would invite me to stay on if the evening had wore on a bit. And quite often an argument would break out over dinner, or I saw it as an argument, and my friend would be saying, oh, for God's sake, Dad, what are you doing that for? And they'd be, oh, for God's sake, Jane, what the hell are you doing now? And I was a bit shocked by this. My family didn't shout, they didn't argue, they certainly didn't shout over the dinner table. And I was probably looking a bit scared at one point. I remember her mum saying to me, oh, it's okay, Matt, it's okay. We just do this all the time. And I was like, oh, right, this is how they do it. This is how they have dinner. They just have these little outbursts with each other, and it isn't a big deal. A sense of belonging and a sense of safety is really important to us as human beings. And yet much of our inner world is conflicted and confusing, and we don't always speak in a way that is consistent with group or family norms. And I can just imagine what would have happened if my friend had come and started shouting at the dinner table in my home. It would have been a very different experience. We'd all have been a bit shocked. And when we see ourselves acting in ways which we suddenly realize don't go down so well with other people, this is a place where the inner critic can really dig in. when we notice that our patterns and our tendencies, our sankharas, when we notice they're not in alignment with those who are around us or our own ideas about who we should be, the inner critic will start criticizing us, blaming us, judging us, and shaming us for being the way that we are. And some of us will hear this as an actual voice, as actual words of criticism. We may recognize the verbal judgments as they arise in our mind. Or we may experience this as a contraction in the body, as a shrinking, a withering. And we hold a lot of shame in our bodies about not being the way we think we should be. And so the practices offered here on this retreat help us to learn to hold all experiences with greater awareness, with greater understanding, and with greater insight, rather than with the familiar evaluation and judgment about what it says about me and how I might look to others. And in the yoga sessions that Helen is offering, there are so many opportunities for comparison, for evaluation, for judging about how our bodies look in relation to others, where our arm or our leg is, whether it should be higher or lower, to the left or the right, whether we should be able to hold it for longer or for less time. Sometimes also just in terms of our own ideas about what we should be capable of. I was one of Helen's yoga students around 20 years ago, and what I particularly appreciated about the way she taught was that this was an awareness-based movement. It wasn't about perfecting the posture. It wasn't about trying to emulate a picture in a book or copy the teacher or the person on the mat next to me, but about learning to move with greater awareness, with greater sensitivity, and letting the movement come from the inside and getting ever more sensitive to how this body is able to move or not move. Many of us come to meditation practice with ideas about how our experience should be. And my guess would be that for most of you, even though we're only at the end of the first full day, is that your experience has not been exactly what you thought it would be, or what you wanted it to be, or how you thought it should be. And just as in life, on retreat, we are challenged by not having things the way we want them. But there is an opportunity here to look more deeply. We are cultivating the ability to choose more consciously how and where we establish our attention. Is it in the realm of comparison and judgment? Or is it in the here and now? Even if most of our day has been occupied by challenging conditions for the body, whether we're doing yoga, or we're sitting, or we're walking, or standing, even if repetitive thoughts, pleasant or unpleasant ones, dominate our mind, can we also bring a compassionate curiosity to these experiences, seeing ever more deeply that our experience does not define who we are? Every single experience is important to us in our practice, so we're not choosing what we give our attention to. We're not only looking to cultivate settled, expansive, or transcendent experiences. Practice is really an invitation to meet the small and the large dramas of our lives with less aversion, with less grasping, and less reactivity. Because if we can really encounter all of our aversion, our grasping, and our reactivity, we're actually in a better place. We can actually know it and not move away from it. In fact, the only doorway to greater freedom is in the moment when aversion and grasping and reactivity arise. and it can be met with a deeper kind of seeing. Very often, as human beings, we have an unconscious project for ourselves in which we are trying to get rid of all the things we don't like, to eradicate everything we judge as not being okay or good enough. However, if we take that approach, then we miss just how subjective our judgments are about ourselves, or how many judgments we've taken on from our parents, our partners, from wider society. So the path to greater freedom actually comes not from perfecting our personality, but being willing to question everything about what we think we are and what we take ourselves to be. And if we cling even to our most cherished, our most valued or praised qualities as being who and what we are, then we will inevitably suffer, as no experience lasts forever. We all know about pain, about physical pain, emotional pain, and psychological pain. We're all deeply vulnerable and relational human beings, and we will all meet our own share of suffering and distress in life. We know about uncertainty and unpredictability, and we know of the world and its changing conditions that can shift almost in the blink of an eye. Car accident, the start of a war, environmental catastrophes, the loss of a job or the end of a relationship. A few lines from a poem by Charles Genauld, another Dharma teacher. He says that the Buddha is simply a man looking at the human condition without complacency. A man facing disease, old age, death and separation. Facing mourning, failures, successes, joys and pains. Life is like this. This is true for the Buddha, it's true for us. Without embodied awareness, our suffering gets compounded. We become a closed system in which thoughts and feelings build on each other and solidify our suffering. And from this painful place, we identify with our pain, our habits and our tendencies as being who we are. And we see this as fixed because it feels fixed. It feels tight, it feels constricted. And from this tightly bound place, we miss the possibility for meeting our experience differently. And freedom eludes us. It is always somewhere else, on the other side of all our issues, of all our pain, of all the difficult things in our life. Yoga practice and Dharma practice offer us an insight into embodied knowing that can take deeper root than just what we know through our minds. It's a broader knowing that acknowledges that a fuller understanding does not only reside in the mind. And when we fully include the body, we can start to close the gap between what we know and how we act in the world. We can start to live more in alignment with our deepest understanding, our deepest intuition, our deepest desires. And we see that in moments where actions of body, speech or mind do not reflect this, we can more compassionately meet ourselves with kindness and with care. And crucially, we not only learn about our own body and how vulnerable we are to change and mortality and the difficulty of navigating a human life, but it also gives us an insight into a more universal understanding that this is also true for all beings. It's true for all bodies, and all of us are deserving of kindness and care. Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and attendant, remarked that mindfulness of the body can truly be considered to be one's best friend. Mindfulness of the body does not simply mean being aware of breathing when we sat on the cushion. Giving our attention to the body, whatever we're doing, is often very revealing about our underlying states of mind. States of mind that perhaps we've not yet brought into consciousness. For example, we might notice that we're rushing. Perhaps we knock a teacup off the table in the dining room. We may notice that we quickly get heated in discussion with family members or partners or work colleagues. Just the very words that come from someone's mouth can leave us feeling hot and bothered. Our breathing can be affected, our muscles start to get activated, and we're getting ready to challenge and object to everything that's being said. Body awareness can give us a great deal of insight into our mind states. When I was younger, I often didn't even realize when I was getting angry. And I would often be surprised by my own reactivity, by just how angry I got. And there were plenty of second arrows in those moments where I judged my behavior, I judged my anger, and I compounded my suffering. But what I started to notice over time was that prior to expressing any kind of anger, I would start to feel a bit agitated. My heart would feel a bit shaky. I might notice a trembling in my fingers. My tone of voice would change. Might become a bit more strident, a bit more direct. And rather than listening, I was building my response, what I was going to say back to whatever was being said to me. And so underneath that experience of anger, there was a sense of threat or a fear of being dominated in some way or misunderstood or maybe not just getting what I wanted. So without a more embodied awareness, we simply react to threats, both perceived and real, rather than really understanding what is happening. Embodied awareness allows us a more direct appreciation of what might be going on at a deeper level for us. And even to ask ourselves the question, what's happening now, can support the curiosity and the investigation that is needed to ease our suffering and to more clearly see how our reactivity gets constructed. There's a lot of skill in learning to work with difficult mind states and learning to work with them through and with the body. Many of our problems would easily be resolved if it were simply a matter of more thinking. And perhaps you've noticed this on your cushion today, that thoughts can spin almost out of control, like we're going to think our way to the end of this particular issue. But we need to give time and space for our body to digest, to metabolize, and to integrate our experiences. Some of them we were too young to even remember. And we can support the body in this through touch, through movement, through compassionately attending to the sensations that might be present, rather than reacting to them. It could be a hand on the heart or on the belly. This can really connect us with our experience. On the night of his awakening, the Buddha reached down and he touched the earth. He touched the earth for support in withstanding the attacks of Mara, the attacks of the hindrances on the depths of his meditation practice. And the breath is a great ally in stabilizing difficult emotions, in finding some steadiness in the midst of a storm of distraction, confusion, anger, irritation. If we can inquire into really what's going on in our experience, it helps us meet our experience in a less complicated way that regulates and soothes the body, regulates and soothes the mind. And it allows us to meet our experience in a way that doesn't make the experience more difficult. In my work as a psychotherapist, one of the things that I see people unconsciously resisting is feeling the fullness of their experience. And I also know this in my own life. Almost as though there is an unquestioned assumption that fully feeling our experience will make it worse, or that we'll somehow be overwhelmed or unable to cope or consumed by it. And yet it takes courage. It takes courage to meet our experience, and having a teacher or a therapist or a trusted friend who can really support us in staying present with our experience can offer us a profoundly new way of relating to what may have previously felt unbearable. This takes courage, and it also takes a willingness not to buy into the unconscious stories our minds and bodies hold. Avoidance and aversion are usually the most familiar ways in which we react to difficult experiences. Dharma teachings invite us to meet our experience with an attitude of, let me see. Let me see what this is. I want to know this. I want to know it deeply. Really allowing our experience to be as it is, taking our hands off and not trying to massage or manipulate things to be the way that we want them to be. When we try and change our experience, we miss opportunities for insight and understanding. And however fiercely the fires are burning inside of us, can we be willing to stay in the presence of those difficult experiences and investigate what they're really made of? This is our path to freedom. And that's really not to suggest that we don't need to take care and good judgment, to really take care, to really go slowly as we meet some of the more painful or foundational hurts of our lives. And we may need the support of a teacher, a therapist, a friend, or a family member in doing that. We go at our own speed. This isn't a race. And it is possible to find increasing freedom in the midst of the conditions of our lives. We don't get our lives sorted out and then we find freedom. So the body is the location in which our experience arises. And our habits to grasp after experience is one of seeing it as I, as me, or as mine. And in doing so, in grasping after our experience in that way, seeing it as who I am solidifies a sense of self. And the greatest freedom comes from seeing through the illusion of a separate, self-existent self. And the deeper understanding that is offered to us through the teachings of the Buddha is that the relative level where we live, we act, and we relate as individuals, with all our personal attributes, with all our stories and our histories, is really true. It really is here. However, if we stay on that level, we rest in a fixed sense of self that is not ultimately real. What we call self, what I refer to as myself, is not some continuously existing thing, but rather a play of dependently arising, impermanent changing elements that give the appearance of solidity in time and space. So we don't want to discard or reject the relative experience of self. We don't want to forget that we are human beings with families and relationships and roles and responsibilities. But rather we need to integrate both the relative self and a more ultimate understanding of self, so that each inform each other. Not understanding that self is a process means that we miss the deeper freedom that the Buddha speaks of. Rejecting the relative self means that we will not care for our own humanity or that of others. When we see this more deeply, it brings forth compassion. When we see that our self, our personality self, our relative self arises as a response to our history, as a response to our conditioning and our suffering, even though it is fundamentally impermanent, we're able to offer it the care, the love, and the nurturing that it needs. And in doing so, we avoid the trap of either reifying and solidifying the personal self as a permanent thing, or denying its existence and its need for care. This compassionate response to the suffering of a separate, independent self is born out of deep wisdom, rather than an idea about how we should behave, how we should be. And that's not to say that we don't actively want to cultivate kindness and compassion in our lives. This is so necessary for ourselves and for the world. But our journey is towards the realization of compassion as a quality of the heart-mind itself. No longer do we have to be compassionate. Instead, we simply are compassion. And we can embody a non-clinging, compassionate response to the suffering of ourselves, the suffering of others, and the suffering of the world. So let's just sit for a moment. So really inviting your awareness into your body. Noticing how it is to be here right now. So we have another walking period. I encourage you to take this time to walk, to be with your bodies, to be with your minds. And is there somebody going to ring the bell? Raise your hand. Great. Yeah, thank you. So So just according to the schedule, 7 minutes before 10 to. Thank you. We'll come back for a final sitting at 10 to 9. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.